Welcome to the Therapist Connect podcast. Dr. Peter Blundell interviews therapists about their work and experiences within the therapist community.
Hello, my name is Peter Blundell, and you're listening to the Therapist Connect podcast. Today, I'm interviewing Jungian psychotherapist Cheryl Fuller. She lives and works in Maine in America, and we connected initially on Twitter through the Therapist Connect hashtag. Cheryl is interested in depth psychology, psychotherapy, feminism, and fat studies, and she's even written a book on fat studies called The Fat Lady Sings, which brings in both some personal experiences, critique of psychoanalytic theory, and the treatment of fatness by the wider therapist community. It's lovely to meet you properly.
Yes,
we've
indeed.
Had some few conversations on Twitter and a few retweets. And I thought it'd be really interesting with yourself living in Maine, USA, which is a bit further away than most of the therapists I'm talking to on Twitter.
Right.
They're usually UK-based. So it'd be a very different perspective, I think, to hear from yourself, which is great.
The end of the world, and I'm way past training.
So how did you come to be a therapist then, and what brought you into the profession?
Well, there's two explanations. Once I started out college as a physics major and was utterly and completely defeated by calculus. So I had only two ways to go, without having to backtrack and pick up more courses. I was an undergraduate at Duke University, and so the two majors I could switch to easily were religion or psychology, and I couldn't imagine what I could do with a religion major, so I changed to psych. But the other piece of it is that my mother my mother was crazy, not in the quirky, eccentric sense, but diagnosable. And that's certainly a breeding ground for therapists.
So two kind of different motivations led
sure.
you down.
They were both part. Yeah, they were both part of it.
Led you down this path. So can you tell us a little bit about your career so far then, since you did your training and where you've been and what you've done since then?
I started graduate school at the University of Connecticut right after I graduated from college in 1968. I hated the program. It was a clinical psych program, which I left all but dissertation because they really didn't want us to become therapists. They wanted us to become academicians. And conceptual leaders. And I couldn't think of any concepts that I wanted to lead around, so I left. And we had to do both a master's thesis and a dissertation. So I left after having completed my thesis, which had been a community mental health project. So I got a job. My husband, then husband, and I moved to Maine in 1972. Mm-hmm. And I had a job at a community mental health center. I designed and directed a therapeutic nursery program for very young children. And my career was going right along with Reagan, who was closing down community mental health centers.
Yeah.
It's just like there's no requirement unless you're in an analytic training program to have personal therapy, which I think is criminal.
Yeah. And I think, supervision and personal therapy is absolutely key for any therapist throughout their career, really.
And I hit my 30s. I'd had my kids. I hit my 30s and I had to figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up. So, decided I wanted a private practice. So that's what I started doing. The clinical psychology in America is, the APA is a guild, has a guild function. And so I didn't want to go back to an APA-approved program because I'd have to start all over again, even though I had experience and had already done all the coursework. So I wasn't sure what to do. So I was really doing independent study of my own. And I would pick up a book on something psychodynamic or psychoanalytic or Jungian, and I would read it. And then I'd go to the bibliography and go through and find what I wanted to read. My analyst once told me I had read more in the field than anybody he knew. I began a personal Jungian analysis. I got lots of supervision. And so I've been in private practice now since 1975.
Wow.
And I've just finished a 25-year-long personal analysis, just because I don't like to do things quickly. I went back to school in 1999. There were three places in the world where I could get a degree in Jungian studies without having to backtrack and do all that clinical mm-hmm. side stuff. One was Pacifica Graduate Institute in California. The other was the University of Essex in the UK. Mm-hmm. And the third was the Union Institute. So I did that because it was a low residency program. And I could do my goal was I wanted to do a dissertation that was a piece of good writing. I was mm-hmm. not interested in learning anything. When I was in graduate school before, mostly what we studied was college sophomores. I figured that the body of information about college sophomores was as complete as it was ever going to be. Mm-hmm. So I went back to school, did my doctorate in Jungian studies, which I did not so that I knew it wasn't going to change how I practiced, but it would make getting published easier, and I would have completed something that I started. Mm. My family has a long history of not finishing things. So it was important to me to finish. And so I finished in 2004 and have continued since. I wrote a book in fat studies and published in 2016.
Fantastic. That's amazing. So I'm really interested in the fact that you spent 25 years doing a personal analysis. I found that absolutely.
I always have to say it was in two chunks.
Two, 11 years. And a half years. Okay.
It was 11 years, and then I left, and 6 years later came back, and okay. I just finished a month ago.
Okay. Wow. And so what was that like, kind of reflecting back on that now?
Well, it certainly changed my life. I have a complicated family that my brothers are 12 and 13 years older than I am. So I always thought of myself as an only child with brothers. Within my family, it's like two separate families altogether. Dad was in the Army when I was growing up. He was not when my brothers were growing up. It gave me space to deal with a lot of family stuff. My mother died during that time period, and my father did. And I got a divorce from my first husband, which, to quote my analyst, although I'll clean up the language, he thought it was effing amazing that I ever left him. and that enabled me, you know, I was single then for 7 years. Mm-hmm. And when I remarried, it was a much better marriage. I'm much happier. And that's certainly an outgrowth of analysis. I'm much more relaxed. I'm not as anxious. Well, I didn't even know I was anxious when I started.
I mean, I think as therapists, we all have that element of wishing to do a self-exploration and look beyond that. But I think that commitment to that as a project towards yourself is quite amazing, really. It's quite fantastic.
Well, I was the Woody Allen of my my world. It was very fruitful. He just retired. I'm not sure if we would have ended. My ex-husband said he was, when I told him I was leaving analysis, he said, I figured one of you would have to die first.
That was the only way it was going to stop.
Yeah, so we didn't die. But it was extremely fruitful. I'm not sure I would have written my book had I not done that work. Certainly made me a better therapist. And just all around has made my life immensely better.
Yeah, it sounds like it's something that you really had a lot of passion for and really of enjoyed doing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
For as long as I can remember having known anything about therapy, I've been drawn to psychodynamic, psychoanalytic approaches, and depth approach really appeals to me. And so I certainly know the principles of CBT. I know how to do that. I don't want to do that. I started out working with young children and their parents. Mm-hmm. Working with little kids, and as soon as I had my kids, I didn't want to do that anymore. It was too much. I'm not a true believer Jungian. I'm sort of an amalgam of I guess, object relations and analytical and Jungian analytical psychology. I like the Jungian approach because it's not pathologizing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're looking at what things mean, not how sick are you. And that really shapes how my practice a lot. I love dreams. So that's really where I look. I call myself Jungian, but I don't know any really good Jungian who's a pure Jungian. I mean, there's no there aren't any pure types. So, I mean, I'll tell you something that has struck me as kind of amusing. When I was training and when I was learning things, we talked about Rogerian approaches, not person-centered.
Yeah.
So when I first read the term person-centered, I thought, well, unless you're a veterinary therapist, we're all person-centered. Yeah. And so I had to look it up and see. And most of what I know here is that that approach is in educational psych. So it's not been a part. I mean, I know it. We learned about it. I read, but that was different for me. If you could drop in and watch any hour, therapy hour, except probably for the most hardcore cognitive behavioral stuff, it all looks the same. It just, you know, what journal are you going to publish in? That's the language that you use.
Cheryl, what advice would you give to somebody who is thinking about entering the profession right now in this day and age?
In the U.S., I'd say steer as clear as possible, if you can, which is hard when you're starting out, from the whole third-party reimbursement stuff, because I was at a wonderful workshop years ago. Fred Plout, who was one of the early Jungians, he practiced in London, said he reminded us that he who pays the piper picks the tune. So if you want to have the agreement between you and your patient be between you and your patient, then it has to be clean. And it's not clean if there's a third party involved. And that's very hard. And people think, oh, no, nobody can. Well, it means you aren't going to get huge, you know, really high fees, but you can make a decent living that way. So that's one part. And I know that at the beginning, people get wedded to whatever approach that they have embraced. But I urge people to spread out as much as possible, you know, to expose yourself as widely as possible. And for God's sakes, hire a supervisor. If you're working in a clinic, that's not supervision. That you're lucky if it's good supervision. Pay for supervision from the best therapist you can find.
But just picking up on your point there in terms of supervision, and I think that is even valid within the UK as well.
Oh,
is that,
sure.
You know, wherever you're working, yeah, of course, you will have supervision and people supporting you within an organization. But to have somebody independent away from that is very, very important, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Which is what I've done all. I mean, I have somebody I call on even now for supervision from time to time. So,
what do you think are the rewards and the challenges that you've had being a therapist over the course of your career?
Can't imagine choosing to be anything else. I really feel like this is what I was meant to do. I experience it as a calling. When people ask me about why I'm a therapist, the most basic thing is I'm nosy. I like hearing about people's lives.
Yeah.
I think it's, and then on a deeper level, I think it's a real privilege to sit with another person as they explore the issues and experiences of their own lives and where they want to go. I mean, I think that's an incredible privilege, you know, that we're all storytellers and I'm blessed to be a part of those stories.
Yeah, couldn't agree more with that. And I think that's one of the privileges, isn't it, of being a therapist, is actually being able to sit with someone and share to some degree their experience and understand where they're coming from, yeah.
Rafael Lopez Pedraza, who was another Jungian, I think he was from Argentina, he talked about how being an analyst, he got to learn all kind of, like when he was working with someone who was in business, and along the way, he learns about business. You know, it's like you have to learn the language that the person that you're working with speaks in their everyday life, which I also think is quite wonderful.
For myself, I work in private practice as well. And so the variety of people that you see is quite amazing, really. Yeah. So one of the things I found was particularly around the Therapist Connect hashtag was just how many people got involved with it, really, from all around the world, which was just amazing. And I just wondered what your experience of it was, and also kind of social media in general, really, for therapists.
Well, I live in a small town on the coast of Maine, which is a small state. There are only 1.5 million people in the whole state. And so already as a Jungian, if I depended just on my community, I wouldn't have a practice. So I've had to extend my reach out anyway. It's very hard for your professional grouping to satisfy the needs for connection. And for me, first of all, I'm quite introverted. And so for me, when social media came along, you know, it's like an introvert's paradise. You know, for a while I thought if I could live my, when it was just text, I thought if I could live my life in text, it would be perfect. So for me, it has expanded my world considerably. And I like that. I have found Martha Crawford, who's on Twitter as Shrink Thinks. I encountered her a couple of years ago. We've had some love. She and another therapist who sadly is now dead. The three of us on Saturday mornings used to have these rather long Twitter discussions about stuff because there's not a lot of opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
It's not cocktail party chatter. You know, it doesn't work that way. And I know for me, I feel disconnected from a lot of what is going on in the therapy world in this country, where they're more concerned about HIPAA rules and what certification do you have in this or that than how to do the work and actually doing the work. So it's allowed me to connect with people who think about the things that I think about.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned to you in one of the emails we exchanged, I've been part of a peer supervision group. We do have an analyst who works with us, and we've been going for 9 years now, 9 years this month. And a member of the group died on the weekend. And so the remainder of us divided up his caseload and made the calls to his patients to tell them that he had died. That's been the most meaningful, that group has been the most meaningful thing for me in terms of connecting with other therapists, because we're all, the analyst and I are the same age. The others are 10, 15 years younger, and so not quite as experienced, but we're all experienced therapists, and it's a place to be with each other. It's not like a personal growth group. We don't talk much about personal stuff, except that the personal and the professional, of course, overlap.
Yeah.
And outside of social media, that's where I found that.
Yeah. And it sounds, I mean, to have attend a group like that for such a long period of time, you must know each other extremely well. So
absolutely.
I imagine losing that colleague and friend of yours must have been kind of quite a shock and, you know.
And to call, yeah, he died of a heart attack on Saturday afternoon, you know? And so I wake up Sunday morning to a text from one of the other members saying he had died. And then I had 8 people to call and deliver bad news, which it's the worst thing I can think of to have to do, because we don't have to do those kinds of things. And it was, to use a Yiddish term, it was a mitzvah to do that. It was a blessing.
Yeah. And I think it's sometimes something maybe we don't think about as therapists as well, actually, isn't it? It's what happens after we're gone.
And who are you going to ask to call you? Because it's not, your spouse can't do that. That's too much of a burden.
Yeah. So I suppose you've got those connections through the groups that you attend, and also then in social media. How do you, what are your thoughts about the wider therapist community then in general? Do you have any thoughts on that? Or
I think Facebook is a terrible place to connect to other therapists. I think Facebook, I'm on Facebook mostly to keep track of my children. And because there's a really good group for the town I live in that's much better than the small weekly paper. And it's a place that I use to promote my practice. So yeah. Other than that, I don't have much use for it. But interestingly enough, I find Twitter a much more rewarding place to participate.
I agree.
and that's, I mean, I think that's incredibly valuable. I think it's just difficult. The client, you know, this is a weird climate. There are lots of pressures on those of us who are therapists who are not psychiatrists to yield to them. I mean, when I started out, I moved to Maine 2 years after a year and a half after the first licensing for psychologists. Social workers couldn't practice independently. Counselors couldn't. Nurses couldn't. So psychologists were the first group after physicians. And the psychiatrists opposed every single added license category. Everyone. And that's a guild function.
Mm. And it makes you think about the idea of power, doesn't it? And who has the power and who doesn't. Yeah,
absolutely. And I mean, I see that cropping up on Twitter also, psychiatrists going at the virtues of the medical model, which was already questionable a zillion years ago when I first started graduate school. So, you know, so there's that, but at least with Twitter, you can connect with other people. And it's almost, I think, unless you're in one of the really large metropolitan areas, I have some friends, a friend who's an analyst in New York. Of course, there are so many analytic institutes in New York that, you know, she doesn't have to go far to find another one. Michael Eigen, who's a psychoanalyst, lovely writer. He has, he's been running a study group kind of for a long time through, Google Groups. And out of that has sprung another group just looking at his book. He's written about 25 books. He's a really interesting and lovely character. That, other than that, I'm hard pressed to think of things like that. I know Donald Carvath, who's a psychoanalyst in Toronto, has a long YouTube series, but how else are we going to find each other if we're in private practice? We're not talking to others.
Absolutely. And I think you'd be surprised that I think even in the UK, it's like that, you know, and most of the training is in London, and the bigger cities. And actually, if you live further out, then actually it's extremely difficult. Yeah, absolutely. I suppose the only thing, I suppose, recently is the very fact that actually online training has just kind of become so huge, you know, even within the last few weeks.
I've been working online for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I left Maine for 4 years. I moved out to Michigan to be with my husband. I had married him when I moved, and I was in school. I was in the graduate program, and I didn't know what to do. And my Anna said, "So take your practice with you." How am I going to do? Said, "You can do that by phone. Print to them, and the ones who want to will can." And they did. And so then when Skype and FaceTime became available, so 2/3 of my practice has been online now for 20 years.
Yeah.
So it feels normal to me. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of amused at people who are paying lots of money for training and how to do therapy online. It's like, it's not that different. I think that's an incredible, right now I have in my caseload people in Canada, in other states, and one in Australia. And I have worked with people in Belgium, in the UK, you know, it's like, and it's not because there aren't therapists where they live, it's that they want the convenience of not having to drive somewhere, find a parking space, you know, all that. So.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is, as well, with working online is that, you know, if you only in your local area, then you're limited to who's there. Whereas now you've got the whole world if you want
to choose
from.
Because like I said, if I was limited to 25 miles of Belfast, I'd be in big trouble.
Yeah. Fantastic. So I've noticed as well that you've got a blog, haven't you, that you write? And I was just wondering how you got started with that, and also kind of how does your writing fit in with your therapy practice or your role as a therapist?
I started the blog in 2007. Mm-hmm. Partly, I've been a writer for a long time, but I hadn't published. And I was a shy writer. And so I thought it was a way of for me to write, to express myself in writing, and have it available to other people to read, but they weren't just my friends. When the HBO show In Treatment came along, mm-hmm. I blogged every episode.
I've seen it on your blog. I was quite impressed when I saw it.
I still get people contacting me because for a while I knew when it was showing in what country. So, and that was fun. It was I loved it. And it turned out to be a good way to attract people to my practice. And what I see is I don't disclose a whole lot about myself, no more than I would to patients anyway. But it enables people to know who I am before they contact me, because I write pretty much the way I talk.
Yeah.
And it lets me express my own ideas and thoughts and enthusiasms about this work. When I first started it, it had three parts. There was what you see now. I also had a whole bunch. I'm an avid knitter. And so I posted about knitting, and I had a section with recipes in it. I still have people asking me about the recipes because, you know, nothing ever goes away on the internet. That's fun.
What was your most popular recipe?
It's a recipe for a Chinese steamed bun. It wasn't mine. It was just one that I made. And chicken paprikash. Who knew?
You know you'll get loads of requests for that now that we've put it in.
And that means I'm going to have to find it. It's a venue for me to... Again, because I'm an introvert, it's a way for me to express myself. Mm-hmm. And there have been times when I couldn't think of things to write or I didn't want to write. So there are gaps in it. But when I had it redesigned in December, and since then I've made the effort to post at least twice a week. I'm working on something now. This, I think, one of the terrible things in this whole COVID-19 thing is this, an exacerbation of the split between millennials and baby boomers.
Mm.
You know, the whole idea that it's okay that older people are more vulnerable. We can just let them. I mean, it's quite appalling.
Yeah.
And so I'm working on a piece for that, but it's taking a while to put it together.
No, I think that's a really interesting point. One of the lines, I've highlighted this, didn't I? Because I sent this to you before we met, but I really, really liked this because it was about self-help books. And I'm going to read it out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never entirely happy with self-help books. In order to appeal to a large audience, in my view, they lose bite in favor of what is palatable and likely to engage masses of readers, rather the same way that food from Taco Bell is suggestive of Mexican food, but lacks the complexity and range of real Mexican food. I loved that line. I wondered what prompted you to write that about self-help books.
I have a certain skepticism about self-help books because in order to be successful, a self-help book has to promise more than it can deliver,
mm-hmm.
because otherwise the market for self-help would dry up. You know, it has to, because it can't, none of those books can deliver people are looking for. That sends them looking for more of them. Although they're not without value, certainly, but it's shallow. Like a book or ideas that take you deeper tend not to sell all that well or demand more than people want to give.
It's like that promise of something, isn't it?
Yep.
And as you say, how easy is it to achieve that just by reading a book, say, for example?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get that and I understand that. Talking about books, you've written your own book.
I did.
called The Fat Lady Sings. I have downloaded a copy, but I haven't managed to read it yet because I became aware of this a few days ago before we spoke. Could you tell the listeners then what it's about and what inspired you to write it?
Well, I'm not going to describe it as a weight problem because it's only a problem if you think it is. But I have been a fat person since I was a child. That means I have contended all of my life, although much less so now, with the biases and issues that flow from that. So it started really out of an argument with my analyst.
Okay.
He used a dream of mine in an article he wrote, which was fine. I gave him my permission. But when he showed me the finished article, there was a line in it that really annoyed me. No, that's too mild. It enraged me. when he said, her weight belies her intelligence. And we argued about that. I mean, he now says that was a terrible and stupid thing to say. Yeah. But it was a very fruitful argument for both of us. There's actually almost everything that's written from a psychological point of view about weight is about what you ought to do to lose weight. And that's the end. Marion Woodman, who is now dead, was a very popular Jungian analyst, wrote a lot of books for women, wrote a book drawn from her dissertation at the Jung Institute, The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter. She tried to make an equivalence between anorexia and being fat, and it doesn't work, but she's not a researcher anyway. And so in my mind, so as I read her book, I mean, I had all these arguments. So it started out in the first part of the book, a big chunk of the book is an argument between me and Marion Woodman. So I imagined being her patient in analysis and how I would respond to these things she said. So that's part of it. Another piece of it is memoirish about how this has been a thing in my life, how I've dealt with it. And then the third part is really directed to therapists and to people seeking to be in therapy, because weight loss, only 2-5% of people who seek to lose more than a few pounds succeed in keeping it off for more than 5 years. It's a lower rate of success than pancreatic cancer treatments. Therapists who see losing weight as a measure of success in therapy or as a reasonable goal are asking their patients to fail and telling them their bodies are wrong. So I wrote about that, and I also wrote about being fat as a trauma of its own. It's not as the result of trauma, but having to move around in the world dealing with the microaggressions that we face all the time is traumatic, and that needs attention. Nobody in the Jungian world had written about fat. Nobody in 50 years. There's very little in the psychoanalytic world. There's lots of cheery, sort of behaviorally oriented self-help stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. Think this thought and you'll lose weight and you'll find true love and happiness. That's why there are so many. Because yes. They don't work. So it's kind of an amalgam. I think it's pretty accessible. I don't do jargon much. I review the literature.
Well, it sounds absolutely fascinating. I think you've explained that really well, and I'm looking forward to kind of delving into it really and having a read of it. What kind of response have you had from people who've read it?
I thought if I sold 20 copies, that would be a big success. So apparently I've sold about 400 copies. I never thought.
Fantastic.
I published with Carnac in the UK just before they got absorbed by Routledge, which is unfortunate because, you know, in a way we were orphaned. You know, the book is still available. I got reviewed in the Fat Studies Journal, which was interesting. And then somebody that I know not really well. I wanted to review it in one of the Jungian journals. But the interesting thing is, the review that she wrote was not so much of the book, but about her experience with somebody that she knew who was very fat. And it was more about her talking about how wonderful she was. So it was a very peculiar review. Mostly what's happened is people have read it. I've got a number of people write to me and email me and tell me that they really liked it. I haven't had anybody tell me they hated it. I think I don't have very many reviews on Amazon, but they've been pretty positive. So
fantastic. Well, I look forward to reading that, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. So one of the things which we haven't really spoken about yet, or we've touched on it a little bit, was obviously the worldwide pandemic that's kind of happening at this moment in time. Yeah. And I suppose I was just wondering, from your own perspective as a therapist, what kind of impact that's had on you, really, and how that's going.
I think the burden of anxiety that we end up carrying because our patients are so anxious, even if they can't, tie it directly to we can't be living in this kind of situation that we're in, where there is this invisible thing out there that we could contract and die from. It's there, and we can't make it go away, and we can't see it, smell it, taste it, feel it, touch it. So it's this kind of existential threat. Of course, everybody is anxious, whether they realize it or not. And so hearing that and having to deal with it and trying to help people to navigate their own lives against this background of anxiety creates a load on me as a therapist. I can't imagine it doesn't on everyone. I haven't been anywhere. I haven't been in contact directly with anybody except my husband for 6 weeks now.
Yeah.
He's a lovely man, but it does get to be a bit much. On the other hand, I see in my town, this isn't as a therapist, but I see in my town, the ways that, and it may be one of the ways that living in a small town is really a blessing, that people pull together and try to help each other out. That's very encouraging to me, but it's a terrible thing.
And it's very strange, isn't it, as well, because in many ways we are all in the same boat. We are all going through exactly the same thing, even though we are all responding to it differently. In different ways and having different things that happen to us. But I can't ever remember ever having that across the world before, certainly not in my lifetime, but I know there have been other pandemics, before this. And it's interesting, us speaking, from the UK to America, and yet actually the two of us haven't really been outside of our house for the last six weeks.
And the other thing I see is I see younger people, like under 40, the people that I'm seeing have a higher level of anxiety than like my age group. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be 74 this summer. If I get sick and I die, I've had a good life. It's like I don't have lots of years ahead of me. My children, who are both in their 40s, do. So it is a bigger factor of anxiety for them than for me. So it's, which I think is interesting. That's not usually the way it is.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting because you mentioned before, didn't you, in terms of some of the responses that people have had in terms of, the age of people who may get it or people with underlying health conditions, and the kind of the attitude is almost different between different generations of people.
Well, among millennials, it's a whole thing like, okay, boomer. It's really, I take umbrage.
I don't blame you. Yeah, I can totally understand that. And I think as well, maybe that's another thing of social media, is actually we're starting to actually realize that actually we're all more connected and more similar than maybe what we thought about before.
And one of the things that I see happened here, the reason that insurance companies have so much power is that therapists don't speak in a single voice. We speak by discipline. And so it's easy to lose. If I ran the world, there would be a single category, psychotherapist. And it's not about if you want to train to be a social worker, that's fine. But if you want to be a psychotherapist, that's an additional leap. And so that it would be the same. And then you'd have a larger group that could speak to issues that affect the field, because we don't do that.
I think, again, to go back to the Therapist Connect idea, was actually one of the things that came out of that was this idea of actually working together collectively. We could have a much stronger voice in terms of advocating for quite a lot of shared values. You know, even though our approaches might be the same, there is a lot of shared values.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That might be a really good note to end on, actually.
Well, I've been delighted to do this. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been lovely to meet you properly and have a chat. And I'm sure we'll chat again.
And do let me know what you think about the book.
I will. I promise I will.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Therapist Connect podcast. Go to www.therapist-connect.com for more discussions and debates.